As I'm pulling off the target, my wingman said, "Dave, I think you've been hit. Looks like you're trailing smoke." I looked down at the instrument panel. I didn't see much of anything going on. I said, "That's probably just cons, because we're in a real high humidity area there." Warning light came on. I had a choice back then, you know, this age-old adage that we have in naval aviation, that it's generally inadvisable to eject over an area that you just bombed. West, I elected not to go east, which would have taken me back over South Vietnam to the South China Sea. Second time, the big bang was out the front and the back of the engine, so it started to unwind, so it was time to get out. The F-8, the canopy did go. You could go through the canopy, but the normal sequence was that the canopy would go. And once the whole thing, I was about 12,000 feet, so the whole sequence kept going, pushed you away from the seat.
Welcome and thanks for listening, or if you're over on YouTube, thanks for watching the podcast. Before you roll in an episode, I want to talk about something that I've been working on for the last year, and that is E3 Aviation Association. This is a membership-based program that is geared towards elevating you on your aviation journey. Whether that be someone who's just starting out as a private pilot or even thinking about taking flying lessons, to the seasoned airline pilot who's flown for decades, military aviation, aviation photographers, mechanics, and everything in between. E3 is here to elevate you on your journey, and I'm excited because we have an awesome team that has come together to help build a phenomenal program, which I'm going to talk about. But before we get rolling into that, E3 is the title sponsor at Sun & Fun. If you haven't been to Sun & Fun, it is a phenomenal air show. So as an annual E3 member, you get access to the VIP chalet right there on the flight line all week long. And as a monthly member, you get a 50% discount on your E3 membership. If you haven't watched an air show VIP style, you'll never want to go back once you do it. But during that week, we have a whole host of aviation experts that are going to be rolling through the E3 tent, doing podcasts, topic talks, meet and greets, and much more. So you don't want to miss out on that. Your E3 Aviation membership gets you access to online tools, courses, webinars, live Q&As, entertaining media, our digital magazine, regional fly-ins and meetups, conferences, our interactive mobile app, and aviation product discounts. This is our launch month, and as part of that launch month, there is the unique opportunity to become a founding member of E3. This is exclusive and limited to the first 5,000 people who join E3, and they become E3 founding members for life. As a founding member, you get early access to events, additional discounted pricing. E3 is a no-risk membership, but becoming a founding member is only limited to this month, so you want to jump in and join in. The part that really gets me excited about E3 is the awesome team we've brought together that are going to help you along your journey. And this ranges from former Top Gun weapons school instructors, the Blue Angels, Thunderbirds, civilian CFIs and double I's, aircraft mechanics, aviation photographers, and much more. Because in the end, it's all about the people, and aviation is a phenomenal community, and we're here to elevate your experience. I'm excited about E3, and I hope you are too. I hope to see you out there. I hope to see you at Sun & Fun. We're gonna take this to the next level, and we're gonna do it with some phenomenal people. If you want more information, or if you want to become one of those limited 5,000 founding members and join in E3, check out the description down below where I have a link. It'll take you over to the E3 Aviation Association website, and you can join in with us. I look forward to seeing you out there. What's up, E3 members? Honored to be sitting here at the National Naval Aviation Museum with Dave Lorenzo. We had the fortunate chance of meeting you the other day. We did a tour around the F-8, which we're going to talk about in this podcast episode. So if you haven't checked that out, definitely go check that out. But sir, thanks for joining me here. It's an honor to be able to sit down and chat and hear a little bit about your path to where you are sitting today. But with that, can you just tell me what got you involved in aviation and then wanted to go in the military in the first place?
Well, I really didn't have any background in the family of military, but I just had this tremendous desire to go to sea. Okay. So I wanted to actually go to the Naval Academy and become a surface warfare officer. Well, I got there, and then things started to change in my mind a little bit, and I started to see about flying. I did some private flying, 172 stuff, of course, on my own back before or on the summer months between the years at the academy. And so I really got interested in aviation and all, too. In the last couple of years there, my company officer was a Marine Corps officer. He was a grunt. He wasn't an aviator. But he was very, very impressive, and he probably is the guy more than anything else that put me into the Marine Corps. So I tried to pass a flight physical at the Naval Academy, and I flunked. I had a half a diopter of astigmatism in one eye, and they only allowed a quarter.
Okay.
And so they said, well, you're not going to make it. So I went to basic school expecting to become an artillery officer. And while I was there, of course, the Marine Corps was starting to get really heavily involved in the Vietnam War, and they were short of pilots. And so they put out the call for more pilots. And so I ended up going up to Bethesda, and they put me in what they call a special myoptic study group. And they took my half a diopter of astigmatism and didn't worry about it. And for a fact, I stayed about until I was about 32 years old. That was almost 10 years, 20/20 in both eyes before it started to degrade a little. But at any rate, I was able to pass the flight physical, and then from the rest of there, we came on down here to Pensacola and started aviation training.
So a couple things. One thing I always talk about, I'm very fortunate, you're very fortunate to be able to sit in a cockpit and go fly, because a lot of stuff you can get medically disqualified early on for things that you're not necessarily aware of. Living a normal life, maybe it's a heart murmur. Again, it doesn't become discovered until you're kind of in the pipeline for an officer commissioning program, et cetera. So again, fortunate, and you just never know. But that time period, I like to ask you about that. Wanting to go to the Naval Academy. It's a much different time period than when I came up. I'm right after 9/11. That was a catalyst and a motivator for me to join. But the socio-political environment during that time period, much different. Did that have any kind of impact on your drive? Was that up at the forefront?
Well, the truth of the matter is I was a big fan of John F. Kennedy's. Okay. He was president back when I was in school and all that too. And his push towards trying to stop the spread of communism in Southeast Asia was very compelling to me. And the fact that I was already in the military, really, because the day induction day at the Naval Academy on July the 5th of 1960, you raise your right hand, you're in. I think they have a 2-year grace period now where they can bail out, but right. We didn't have that choice back then. But at any rate, we were in, and we were, most of us were really gung-ho. You coming out of the academy back in those days, you knew one thing. If you were going to fly airplanes, you were going to war. It was a guarantee, no doubt about it. And so we were all pretty gung-ho about it and all, too. Socioeconomic problems a little bit later in the 1960s, when pretty much everybody turned against the Vietnam War. That got to be a bit of a downer. But at the earlier stages of my career, no, we were ready to go.
So fighting communism, stopping the spread of communism.
Yeah, we were believers. We really were believers. We felt that was worthwhile to go to war for, and most of us did.
Talk to me about pilot training and then the next few years after pilot training.
Extensive pilot training back in the day. We started out in the T-34, the Mentor. There's one hanging from the ceiling right behind us over here. That was our primary trainer. I was lucky enough to have about 25, 30 hours in 172 time when I got into it. So flying airplanes wasn't unique to me. Upside down was, but not right side up anyway. And so our T-34 training, we ended up about 35, 40 hours or so in that. And then we went to what we call primary jet training. That was Meridian, and the aircraft was the T-2, the Buckeye. It was a single engine version of the T-2, straight wing airplane, very docile aircraft. And that was our primary trainer. We went through a syllabus there that lasted about 6 to 7 months and took us all the way through formation flying, some instrument work, but not a whole lot. The interesting thing about my last hop at Meridian, which is kind of interesting, it was a four-plane hop, and we were all four of us Marines, right? And our chase pilot was going to be Lieutenant Commander John McCain. Mm-hmm. And so John McCain was our chase pilot. Well, John, bless his heart, was probably not the best stick in the world in his day. He had that reputation. So he ended up taking off, and unfortunately he didn't do a very good pre-flight, and he took off with the cover still on his angle of attack indicator.
Ooh, yeah.
So the T-2 immediately goes into rudder shaker, which in this case was on the rudder pedals. And he said, I'm not going to worry about it, I'll just keep going. Well, of course, the next thing you know, that little motor burned up. He was all full of smoke in his cockpit and everything. So he had to come back around and lay in and get another aircraft. But there's the four of us up there doing our best version of Blue Angels right over downtown Meridia in our four-plane diamond formation. But John was our instructor for that last hop, which I thought was kind of interesting anyway.
You know, it's funny, those lessons, because those stories permeate through, you know, the Air Force with either frozen AOA indexers, and that was a static import that happened in the Viper. In one case, we lost two F-16s because they froze over because the probe heat wasn't turned on. It's simple things like that. We've lost a B-2 with moisture inside a probe, et cetera. So,
well, at least you took the cover off.
You want to take the cover
that's
off.
That's a good sign. The one that says remove before flight.
Right. That's why they're bright orange or red or whatever it might be. Yeah. You got to pay attention to that walk down and just take your time there a little bit. So going through Meridian, that time period, I have some time in Mississippi myself, and I would duck into Meridian to do a PAR approach. Yeah. You mentioned not doing much instrument flying.
Yeah.
Things have changed a little bit over the years, but I was interested to learn that most Navy aircraft, at least the Hornet, except for the Blue Angels, they don't have an ILS in them.
No.
And yeah, that's the bread and butter when it comes back to an instrument recovery usually.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. And it left us just TACAN approaches. Or ADF, which is, you know, very, very unreliable.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah. It was pretty basic stuff back then. So once we left Marine, we came back here to NAS Pensacola and VT-4, which is still exists, but it's primarily a simulator squadron now.
Okay.
In VT-4, we came back down here and we did air-to-air gunnery in the T-2, and we did carrier quals. So we got a full set of carrier quals in on the T-2 as well.
How long did that last?
That was about a month, maybe 6 weeks here.
And when you're doing that carrier qualification, how many landings are you getting? Like, how many days does that take up?
Normally a two-day deal. We'd go out, and the first day out there, we'd do bounces. They wouldn't let us drop the hook. You just go down and do a couple of bounces, and then you come back around. If they feel that you're good enough, they go ahead and say, okay, drop your hook, and we'll make an arrested landing. And then, of course, you get the catch shots and all, too, with that, which was very interesting. You know, it's the first time you ever get shot off a ship on the CAD. It's really quite a thrill. You're pulling a lot of G's, but they're not vertical G's, they're horizontal G's. And so you get the feeling you're almost like going over the top of a roller coaster when they fire you off. Even the little T-2 was quite a trip. We had a carrier here then, the USS Lexington. It was our training carrier. It was home ported right here in Pensacola.
Okay.
So we always did all of our training flights off of the USS Lexington. And then when we completed that, it was out to either Kingsville or Beeville for advanced training. Our trainers back then were the F-9, the Cougar, which is the swept-wing version of the F-9. And it was Grumman's finest. It was a lead sled, you know. That's exactly what it was. They could take a lot of beating, and they took a lot of beating and training out there, too. But it was a fun airplane to fly. And we went through a full syllabus with that, too, which lasted, I think I was about 22 months doing the whole training thing.
From start to finish here, Pensacola, Meridian, back to Pensacola.
Yeah, the only thing that held us up back then, we didn't have the delays like the kids do today, but we ended up with a lot of weather days, especially up in Meridian in the winter months up there. The weather wasn't the best.
No delays, is that because based on the environment and the need for...
Well, yeah, back then, I mean, it was pretty obvious. We were in war, and we had to have pretty high turnover, so they kept us moving right through pretty well.
How many people did you graduate with, you know, roughly?
When you're talking graduate, you mean am I pinning on wings and all?
If we go talk about a pilot training class to a jet class.
No, by that time you're spread out so much, it just happened at different times. You know, you might have two or three at the same time that got their wings on, but we didn't have class graduation like they do in a lot of cases now, no.
Okay.
It was just individually. And because, you know, you would finish the syllabus at different times, they wouldn't keep you waiting around for a class to graduate. They'd pin you and send you to your operational squadron.
Wrapping up that training iteration, I assume then you're off to your first operational squadron?
It does. In the Marine Corps, we went right to whatever base we were going to fly out of. And, of course, we didn't have special training squadrons like the Navy did back then. You actually went to right operational squadron, and they would teach you the airplane in the operational squadron. And I checked in at Beaufort, Marine Corps Station Beaufort, and the guy gave me an option of either going to an F-4 squadron right away, we're hanging out for an F-8 squadron that was coming back off a med cruise in about a week. So I elected the F-8, obviously. That was my choice. So I waited for the squadron to come in, and then I joined the F-8 squadron.
So we call them B courses in the Air Force, the basic course where you learn to fly the F-16, the F-15. Navy, I think, calls it the RAG.
Yeah.
So You're doing it in-house training.
We were right into an operational squadron, that's correct. And they had a syllabus, and it was an extensive syllabus, because not only was the training you to fly the airplane, it was training you to fly the airplane in combat. And so it took almost, I'd say, a year of training there before we were sent over to Vietnam. And we did, the D model of the F-8 we were flying did not have hard points on the wings, so we couldn't carry any ordnance. We couldn't do any bombing, if you will. But we did simulations. We'd go out and get into that 70-degree dive angle that we looked for dropping dumb bombs. We did a lot of work out in Yuma, the Chocolate Mountain Range out there, where you could do live firing. There are very few places here on the East Coast where right. You could actually do live firing.
Yeah, and obviously it's gotten worse since then. But what made you want to pick the F-8 over the F-4?
Reputation. It was the hot rod of its day. I think everybody used to say the last of the gunfighters, you know. It was, yeah. And it was not an easy airplane to fly. It was a difficult airplane to fly.
What was challenging about it?
Well, the most challenging thing, of course, was probably the fact that variable incidence wing on there. And the other thing was, too, that you couldn't get low and slow on that airplane, especially if you're coming aboard an aircraft carrier. You wanted to make sure you kept your speed up. You got low and slow, and that with that big wing up was a tremendous amount of drag on the airplane. If you got low and slow, even though you had a powerful engine on there, you may and may not be able to recover. So she was a tough airplane to bring aboard. You had to be very, very careful. Although I never actually flew the F-8 off of a carrier. When we went to Vietnam, we were stationed. What the Navy did, or Marine Corps did, is they pulled all of their squadrons off of naval aircraft carriers and land-based them.
Okay.
And instead of moving the squadrons, they left the squadrons in place and they rotated pilots in and out. We operated out of either Da Nang Air Base or Chu Lai Air Base. Those were the two bases that we operated out of in South Vietnam.
Did you ever get carrier qualified in the F-8 then? Or?
I did not, but okay. We flew it off of a thing called a SATS field.
Okay.
Which was an awful lot, was similar to a carrier because you had a resting gear, you had a catapult system to launch you and all too. So I did fly it off of the SATS fields, but I never did fly it off of a carrier.
When you gave us the tour of the F-8, I was just looking at it. One, being an F-16, I feel like spoiled with the bubble canopy. You feel like you're sitting in a telephone pole and you can see very well. Obviously there's a HUD. You fly angle of attack for landing. But even with F-16, you have to be careful not to scrape the turkey feathers on the exhaust can based on it. Looking at the F-8, just how close that tail is to the ground, it looks like that's something that would be a challenge.
Yeah, you cannot aerodynamic brake. I know you guys like the aerodynamic brake in the Air Force a lot. You couldn't do that in that airplane because you'd be dragging the tail for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like the clearance on that thing is not made.
Not very much
maybe
at all.
Maybe a foot.
Well, that variable incidence wing, some people say you're raising the wing, other people say you're lowering the fuselage. But whichever way it is, it still didn't give you a whole lot of room between the tail and the ground when you landed. No?
Yeah, it looks like it was a fun plane to fly. And I think, again, we talked about it being a fast plane, especially in that day and age, which would have been pretty exciting to fly.
Yeah, it really was, yeah. Like I mentioned, the first flight before in the thing, there were no two-seaters. So the first time you strap it on, you strapped it on. And I never did fly an airplane with a afterburner in training. So we take off and the chase pilot's back there. And the one thing I'm really worried about is making sure I get that wing down and locked by 220 knots. Next thing I know, I'm going through 20,000 feet and my chase pilot's hollering, "Will you please come out of burner? I can't catch you." But I did get the wing down and locked. As you got there in a hurry, the F-8 had a single stage burner. So when you lit it, you got it all right away. It wasn't staged.
So I'm thinking too, that time frame, obviously the nation's at war, the nation needs fighter pilots. And I would imagine the rotation through the squadron. What is the ops tempo in the squadron? Are guys forward deployed or is the whole squadron at home? And then you're going together once you get through training. What was that environment like?
Well, VMFAW 451 in Beaufort, South Carolina was the squadron I joined right out of training. And that was a full operationally squadron. Like I said, they just came back off of a med cruise. They had the D models, which were probably the premier fighter versions of it back in those days, too. And like I said, we had no hard points on the wing, so we couldn't do any air to ground except simulate it when we went out to Yuma. But the syllabus that they put us through was very, very extensive. Especially in air-to-air combat stuff, too. The other thing we got to do back then, this was when we had a hot pad down in Key West, Florida. This was during just right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so whenever the Cuban MiGs were out chasing our Coast Guard aircraft around, we'd go launch out of our hot pad down there in Key West, Florida, and go chase after the MiGs and chase them back into their base which was, I think, San Antonio was the name of the base, just to the west of Havana down there. But at any rate, that was kind of fun stuff. You know, after Burner, go Burner and go all the way down there, chase after MiG-21s.
Was that something that's happened often? I mean, to me, that's fascinating. I mean, hear more about that.
Well, hot pad, of course, you're standing in the hot pad. If you're on call, you're sitting right in the trailer, right next to the flight line where the aircraft are sitting there all ready to go. And if they push a button on you, which they did for quite frequently back then, because all of these MiG-21s were coming out of Havana over there. They were chasing after our Coast Guard airplanes, mostly was what they were after. The Coast Guard was out there trying to rescue the people that are trying to leave Cuba, right, coming to the States.
That time period, so MiG-21s getting chased down, is that Russians that are flying, or Soviets that are flying those?
No, they were Cuban pilots. And the Soviets were down there teaching them how to fly.
Okay.
But I assume that they were Cuban pilots that were flying it.
What an interesting time.
They would not, they wouldn't engage us. They wouldn't even get near us. They saw us coming, the radar would pick us up coming in that way. They'd chase them right back to their base. They wouldn't have anything to do with us.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Just trying to keep them away from our Coast Guard guys that were out there trying to pick up all of the people who are trying to leave the island to Cuba. So.
You did that before going to Vietnam, or was that?
Yeah, that was before. Yeah, when I was still at 451 there too. So. It was interesting.
Yeah, to say the least. Again, that time period, yeah. There's a lot that's going on in the world that.
Indeed.
You know, I've been able to see in the movies or read it in history books, but to kind of hear your first person experience is really cool for me.
It was kind of a fun time to be in the military. You knew you were going to get challenged. You knew.
Yeah.
And that's what I think a lot of us at that particular time frame, you know, in our early 20s like that, we were bulletproof. And so you want to be challenged. So.
Right. Yeah, you want to get out there and do the job you're training for.
And life's a lot different when guys are shooting at you, trust me. That makes a big difference, too. So.
How long were you doing that before going to Vietnam?
I was in the squadron almost a year, a year, before we went through the full syllabus. Okay. And the commanding officer of 451 was going over to take over the squadron, which was VMFAW 235 in Da Nang. And I had completed the syllabus and all, asked to go with him, and he took me along.
How many people, was it just you and the commander went over and then?
No, there were a couple of others, several others that went with us as well too. There weren't that many guys that had F-8 MOSs back then. They were being phased out of the Marine Corps.
Okay.
In fact, 235, the squadron I joined in Da Nang, was the last active duty F-8 squadron in the Marine Corps.
When you're going over there, are you taking your own jets, your squadron jets?
No,
they're already there.
That's already there. Yeah, they decided to just leave the squadrons in place and just rotate the pilots.
Okay.
And this was the 67, 68 time frame.
All right, so talk to me about that time frame, 67, 68. What was the conflict looking like? What was the tempo of things, and how were things going?
We were pretty high tempo back in those days. This was just before Tet. Tet, of course, happened in February of 68, which was probably the most active time at all, that at least when I was over there as well. But the tempo was pretty high. You would fly at least one mission a day in most cases. Maybe occasionally, if you had to, you could have more than one. Just depending upon what pilots were available, what aircraft were available, and all too. The E models of the F-8 that we had over there were the newest models at that particular time. But keeping them up was a problem. We'd have 18 to 20 aircraft in the squadron. But out of those 18 or 20, if we had 10 to 12 that were ready to go, that would be about standard.
Was that maintenance LIMFACs?
It was all kinds of stuff. Yeah, mostly maintenance stuff. Of course, we lost a few, too. I did my part. I lost one, two for them. But at any rate,
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it was a pretty up-tempo time.
And what were the missions? What was kind of the average day in the life of? What were you guys going out there doing?
A lot of close air support for the Marines on the ground in I Corps. We did an awful lot of that. We did interdiction missions on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. With a 20-millimeter cannon in the nose of the aircraft, we could also be very, very accurate. So a lot of times we do search and rescue missions.
Okay.
If the Air Force didn't have a Sandy or something there that was available, they'd call us in. And we could get really close to the good guy without hurting him and keep the bad guys away, too. It was a pretty upbeat time. TPQs were radar missions. They'd fly those at night. We'd be just flying along, and they would have a radar operator looking at you, and he knew what the ordnance you had, and he knew the target, and he knew everything, where he wanted the aircraft dropped, he would be teaching you or talking you into one degree heading changes, actually, or one or two degree heading. Yeah, they were fairly accurate, and he'd give you the exact release point. We're competing with the Blue Angels now, too, by the way.
So. You know, it's a good environment to be in. Obviously, being surrounded by all this aviation piece and then having the Blue Angels fly up, it's a perfect environment to be at.
It is, yeah. I think.
Talk about the TPQ mission. That's something, again, that's...
There was a radar control drop. They were watching us on radar. They would show us, take us to the point. They'd give us an altitude to fly at. They'd give us a load that they wanted to drop. And they would, with the basis of that information, they would have an exact point where they wanted you to release the ordnance. And so you're just basically flying along. This was all done at night, you know, too. But at any rate, it was a very easy mission, if you will. I mean, it wasn't much to them at all. We would do some up with the southern part of North Vietnam, but most of it was done over the northern part of South Vietnam.
Yeah. To me, that's pretty impressive, obviously, the accuracy that goes into it. Now you can do that with GPS and the jets, so that doesn't exist. But even flying at nighttime, you know, enemy radar sites still work at nighttime.
Sure.
I know you mentioned it's kind of, those are easier, benign missions, because I imagine driving straight and level, but you still had a threat out there to deal with.
Well, yeah, You know, I mean, it was always a possibility, depending on where the SAMs were, you know. If you were up in the southern part of North Vietnam, you could easily get into their territory.
And in that time period, too, I mean, was that the concern once you got up into northern Vietnam?
It was, yeah. Like, that's... Primarily, it was the surface-to-air missiles, yeah.
And were you worried, I guess, was there a predominant threat that you were concerned with, or was it just all of it during that time?
Well, all of it, really. Of course, most of the work that we were doing in the F-8 was close air support, so we were down low and slow, so our biggest problem was ground fire.
Was there a lot of shoulder fire missiles? Was that of a concern? Was it all just kind of AAA?
Pretty much all AAA back then. I don't think we had anything quite like the missile systems that they have today, the shoulder fired missiles or hand carried missiles. But you had a tremendous amount of anti-aircraft fire.
Talk to me about the challenges of flying close air support in that day with one, probably just being able to visually acquire the guys on the ground that you're helping out, the enemy, radios, terrain. What were some of the things you were having to deal with to fly?
Well, terrain could be a challenge at times too. We could work in places like Khe Sanh, which was a well familiar name. It was a small airfield. It was up in the northwestern part of South Vietnam, and that was hilly. And of course, most of everything we were doing there, we had to get down pretty close to the ground. We were dropping things like snake eye bombs, you know, the ones with the fins on them. They retard them, so you could do right at a fairly shallow angle, a dive angle. And the Zuni rockets, the 20-millimeter cannon and all that stuff, you were just down there in the weeds with them. And so those were challenging. The most challenging missions for me were at night when we had to fly under the flares. We didn't have any night vision goggles or anything back then, so you'd have a C-130 flying over the target area and he'd drop flares and you had to make your runs underneath the flares. You lose a tremendous amount of your depth perception in there, and it can get a little hairy flying those things at night, especially in places like the Eshowa Valley, things like that, where the terrain was a real factor as well, too.
Yeah, a little hairy, I might say, is an understatement. That sounds
really
hairy. What was it like coordinating with C-130s, having them drop, dealing, again, like, I imagine you have a bright flare, you can see the ground, but that's also messing with your natural night vision
as
you transition to probably deconflicting from your wingman, et cetera.
Yeah, you had several challenges there, too. Those Zuni rockets that we talked about, if you had your eyes open when you fired one of those things, you lost your night vision completely. So you actually got yourself in a position where you're ready to fire, close your eyes, shoot the missile, and then you can open your eyes back up again so you didn't go night blind on them. But the 20-millimeter cannon, of course, we use those a lot at night as well, too. And we'd load some tracers in there so you'd be able to see where your hits were and all, too. So it was a challenge. I have to say the night flying under the flares was probably about the hairiest.
That sounds really sporty. Several missions over North Vietnam, as we've alluded to in the previous kind of discussion. But I want to talk about the night, you know, you always talk about takeoffs matching landings. Unfortunately, you got one less landing, I think, than
it was my 98th mission. I got bagged. It was an interdiction mission in the Ho Chi Minh Trail over the central part of Laos. I'd taken off from Da Nang with a section. I was section lead. And the idea behind this thing was a place where the Ho Chi Minh Trail came down the side of a mountain with a bunch of switchbacks on it.
Okay.
And the idea behind it was to cave the mountainside in on the switchbacks so that it would block the road it was a single lane road in most of the places in Laos, so if you blocked it, you had traffic start to back up on it, and then that would be a sitting duck for a follow-on attack missions as well. So my wingman ran in, he dropped his ordnance, pulled off the target, and I tried to figure out a running heading would probably be the least likely that I would be bagged on, if you would. But unfortunately, those guys were pretty good. They've been sitting there for a year or two doing nothing but shooting at American airplanes, and they pretty much had the routine down. As I pulled it off the target, my wingman said, "Dave, I think you've been hit. Looks like you're trailing smoke." I looked down at the instrument panel. I didn't see much of anything going on. I said, "Ah, that's probably just cons, because we're in a real high humidity area there." But shortly after that, the lights started to come on. You know, yellow ones at first, right? You know, you get hydraulic one, and then you got your utility hydraulic, engine oil pressure low, this, that, and the other. And finally, even the engine fire warning light came on. I had a choice back then, you know, with this age-old adage that we have in naval aviation, that it's generally inadvisable to eject over an area that you just bombed. So trying to get as far away from there as I possibly could, we started heading west. I elected not to go east, which would have taken me back over South Vietnam to the South China Sea. And I elected to go to the west to try and get to Thailand, and get across the Thai border. I locked the throttle down at about 92% RPM, trying not to accelerate or decelerate the engine, seeing if I could lock the lubrication in as much as I could on the bearings and all. Right. And that J57 engine ran for about 5 or 6 minutes for me with very low or no oil pressure. It was really a lifesaver, to say the least. I got to 12,000 feet, and I was joined up by an F-4 that was coming off a PAC-6 mission, going back to Yuban Air Force Base. And of course, all this time I was able to talk to the people on guard, telling them I was in extremis and probably would need help. I didn't make it to Yuban, so I had to go ahead and eject. The first big bang I got, the guy that was chasing me, I said, "Dave, you had about 15 feet of flyer at the tail of your aircraft there." And I said, "Well, it's still running. I'll hang on a little while longer." You know? And then finally, the second time, the big bang was out the front and the back of the engine. So it started to unwind, so it was time to get out. The ejection system, it was a Martin Baker, was in a F5 seat. It was a powder seat. It wasn't a rocket like you got today. And so when you fired that thing, you went, I mean, like right away. Yeah. The F8, the canopy did go. You could go through the canopy, but the normal sequence was that the canopy would go. And once the whole thing, I was about 12,000 feet, so the whole sequence kept going, pushed you away from the seat. So, the chute deployed fully and completely. And you looked up and you see this absolutely beautiful canopy above you up there with all the panels intact. And wow, it worked. How neat is that? And then you look down, you see your airplane making its final approach, just heading for the ground. Pretty sad. But I was hanging there in the straps for a good while at 12,000 feet. You got a lot of time in the straps.
12 minutes, 13 minutes.
Yeah, you worry a little bit. You know, the Marcus of Queensbury rules were off over there. They take pot shots at you hanging in the straps, no doubt. But luckily, I'd gotten far enough away from the bad guys. I didn't have to worry about it. Misjudged the ground, and my knee came up and hit my chin, split my lip. But that's the worst of it. I walked away from it without any problems after that. You've got a couple of thoughts. You got going down there. You say, "Well, I don't see anybody around here, but now if I hit the ground and there is somebody there, do I want to start a firefight with my little 38 snub nose against some guy with an automatic weapon?" You know.
Right.
So you hit the ground, and the first thing you're looking for is some place to hide. So I find some scrub brushes to hide under. Left the chute, left my escape or my seat back, all the survival gear and everything. Just let it scattered all over the wall, all over the place, and just went. Looking to hide he wouldn't hide in the bush somewhere. And I'd been talking to the guys and telling them, you know, I was in trouble. So they had launched the helicopter. So I was only on the ground about 20, maybe 30 minutes at the most until they came and picked me up. And all the stuff that I left scattered around as well, too.
That's incredible. I mean, obviously being able to get out and get away a good bit, being able to talk on the radio.
I was a lucky fellow. I was a very lucky fellow, no doubt.
You're dealing with a lot of things. We do survival school, and they do some case studies of different things, one of which an F-117 that went down. But in the chute, he's talking on the radio. So his pickup was very quick versus Scott O'Grady, who got shot down in the F-16. Mm-hmm. He spent some time evading on the ground.
Right.
And then just trying to talk about just getting the rescue forces going, and you trying to get as close to them as possible is a huge deal. So,
I was a very lucky guy. The J57 engine, I still swear by it. That was quite the thing.
I imagine you're trying to figure. you're not really thinking about a bunch of things other than trying to get to good guy land and probably stick with the aircraft.
But I thought I could make it all the way to U-Bahn. I'd try and land a thing, you know. If I had to do a power off landing, you know, we used to do those high key, low key. You remember
right,
those?
Yep,
power off landing. But unfortunately, we didn't get that far. Or maybe fortunately, right. We didn't get that far. Right. That might have been an absolute disaster, too, if we'd have tried it. So who knows?
How did you end up with an F-4 on your wing? Where'd your wingman end up?
I sent him back. We were right at the end of our combat radius, and I sent him back home. This F-4 was coming along about that time, and he stayed with me the rest of the way until they picked me up.
Which, again, yeah, you just said, that F-4 picked you up. There's still some finesse that goes into coordinating that. So you kick your wingman off, get him going home, and then was it talking on? Is there a common
frequency? I was on guard.
Yes.
I was hollering on guard, you know.
Everyone's
I gave up on any tactical frequencies. I was a help.
Right.
You know? But, yeah, everybody was very, very good about trying to make sure that this thing came out successfully. And luckily for me, it did.
Did you get picked up by Jolly Greens?
Or
did
it was actually the U-Bahn Air Force's rescue helicopter, the one that was based there in the base.
Okay.
It wasn't specifically Jolly Green, but it was the same type of aircraft, but it was based with the U-Bahn Air Force Base.
What happened after you got picked up? What was the kind of the next few days, weeks?
Well, it was kind of interesting, you know, when I got back to U-Bahn, of course, the first thing they wanted to do is let a flight surgeon look me over, and he did. And he said, you're looking good. He said, no reason for you to stay here. He wants you to go back to Da Nang. He did give me a pint of whiskey.
Yeah.
That was good. And I enjoyed that at the back of C-130, or C-47, rather, on the way back to Da Nang. And, but I wanted to get back on the flight schedule right away. Last thing you want to do when something like that happens is just sit on the ground and think right. about it. You want to get back in the saddle again as quick as you can. They wouldn't let me fly the next day, but they let me fly the day after that. And so I got back into it pretty quickly.
Oh, that's awesome.
Plus the other fact, they were pretty short of pilots anyway, yeah. So.
There was a need.
Yeah, needs of the service.
Was it AAA that?
I thought it was 37 millimeter, but it's my understanding that eventually they got to that aircraft, the wrecked aircraft, and they said it was 50 caliber.
Okay.
I couldn't, because 37 millimeter, you could normally see that, looked like a white bird. That they would, you know, because of the condensation around the shell as it was passing by you, you could actually see them when they got close.
It's a big bullet.
Yeah, the 50 caliber, unless there were tracers on it, you never would see. So,
man, that is an incredible story. What was the next few months? So you're back on the flying schedule.
Yeah, that was my 98th mission. I ended up with 200 before we finally left. I really was lucky because most guys, I was an 03. Most guys that were O3s at that time had to go do a forward air controller mission. You either went to a battalion or you went to a company or you went to some god-awful place down there where they would stick you for about 3 or 4 months and let you become the forward air controller for that particular group. But there were so few of us that had F-8 MOSs that were company grade. There were plenty of field grade, but not too many company grades. So they let me stick with the squadron. And the other lucky thing that happened to me about that time, there was a spy ship called the Pueblo, and the North Koreans had taken the Pueblo, had taken the aircraft, or taken the ship, and hauled it back into somewhere in North Korea, I guess. But at any rate, they had no fighter assets anywhere in the Western Pacific except in country, in Vietnam. So wanting a fighter squadron, they said, okay, we're going to take that F-8 squadron, we're going to move them up to Iwakuni, Japan. So you can imagine how excited we were about leaving Da Nang, going to Iwakuni, Japan, where we were the absolute only squadron. And they took our F-80s away from us, and they gave us a couple of old F-8B models, which were the second version of the aircraft. And they were not in the best of shape, but we had some really great maintenance guys who were able to keep them going for us. And we operated out of Iwakuni for about 3 or 4 months. We did nothing but air-to-air. That's all we did, because the B model didn't have anything to do, no air ground capability at all. Yeah, you couldn't do any live firing or anything around the Japanese mainland, so we had to go down to Okinawa, and we go down to Naha, Okinawa, where we do our live firing exercises, and we did some fancy stuff. We did air-to-air combat, we did air-to-air gunnery, subsonic and supersonic pattern, which is something I've never even knew it was capable, but inside the reversal, you're at 1.1 Mach, you know. We had to tow our own banners because we had no contractors over there. So they put a banner tow where the Sidewinder missiles would go. They'd hang that thing on there, and then you'd run your couple thousand feet of cable out on the banner, tow it with an F-8. That was exciting too.
Who drew the short straw to be out front?
Being like I said, there weren't many of us company grade officers back then. So guess who?
I've shot the banner, but with contractors towing the banner, well, yeah.
No contractors back then.
Yeah, I was like, I know some of the guys, you know, some of the lieutenants.
Well, especially when you start talking about a supersonic pattern where you're 1.1 in a reversal and all, I'm thinking, man, you don't want to pull too hard on that nose.
Not much between the banner and that when you're going that speed.
No, not at that kind of speed. Perch around 30,000 feet in reversals. We would tow around, I don't know, around 20, 22,000, somewhere around there. It was exciting. But
again, maybe our definition of exciting might vary slightly, but
well, like I told you, you want to challenge yourself. We challenged ourselves quite a bit with that aircraft and the squadrons I was in.
Were you guys doing anything with the USS Pueblo, or is that just? I mean, that's why you got relocated.
The only reason they moved us up there is in case something like that happened again. We couldn't go. No, they didn't send us to Korea at all. No, we were just basically on standby.
Okay,
but it was kind of nice. We were the only squadron in Iwakuni at the time, and there's a neat little town, and we had the whole place to ourselves. It was very nice. And like I said, nothing but air to air. That's all we were doing. It was fun stuff.
And that, I mean, you had 200 combat missions up to that point, then 3 months roughly in Japan, and then you're back stateside?
Yeah, after the tour in Japan, they took the squadron flag, and they moved it over to Hawaii, and they made an F-4 squadron out of 235 became an F-4 squadron. And I got a job back at Meridian, Mississippi in VT-7 as a flight instructor.
Okay.
And I stayed there for about a year, and then it came time for me to move on from my flight instructor tour. And so I called a detailer and I said, what do you got planned for me? And he said, well, Dave, I think we're going to cross train you into helicopters. And the Marine Corps was doing a lot of that back in the day. Yeah, well, helicopter pilot's lifespan was a lot shorter than fixed wing back then. And I gave it a little thought and I said, nah. I escaped that one tour high and fast. I don't particularly want to go back low and slow for another try at it. So I went ahead and gave up my commission and went to work for Delta Airlines at that time.
Did a full career there?
33 years, 32 years, 10 months. Yeah.
Not that anyone's counting.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a beautiful career. It really was. I enjoyed it very much. I was sad in a way to give up a commission, a regular commission that I had in the Marine Corps. And I didn't want to do that. But by the time, that was 1970, and it was pretty obvious then that the war was over. I mean, it was lost for all practical purposes. And it wasn't, of course, until President Nixon started the linebacker B-52 bombings and everything that finally drew the guys to the table there, and they came up with some sort of a solution. But I lost all that challenge and all of that gung-ho that I had back in 1964 when we were 3 and 4 when we were talking about going to Vietnam. It had worn off by then.
Yeah, you've kind of been around the block and seen it. I was going to ask, do you think you would have stayed in had they not tried to send you to go fly helicopters?
I think if they'd put me in an F-4 squadron, I probably would have stayed. I really do. Yeah. Okay. I was a fighter pilot. That's what I felt like. Anything else other than that, I said, if I'm going to have to fly low, if I'm going to have to fly something else, I might as well go make a lot of money doing it, right?
Yeah.
I hit it at a good time. It was pretty much the golden age of commercial aviation in 1970 when I came in, just transitioning over from props to jets, and it was a... The airlines back then could make money with a 35% load factor,
right.
Even 90% like they got to have now or whatever. It was pretty much a fun deal back in the day. But again, I really didn't want to give up that commission, but you worked hard for it, get through the academy for 4 years.
Right. Dedicated your youthful years, essentially the best years, some might say, that.
Yeah, and it was it was a different place too, the academy, wasn't it, is today. It was an all male school back in the military academy. Plebe years were really difficult. I mean, I had a guy that was after me the entire plebe year there. I'll never forget his name. His name was Dick Curley. And he'd go to we had these come arounds in the morning, where you had to be there right at the reveille time. You had to be in, and you had to do all these calisthenics and stuff like that. And he'd be sitting there in his underwear reading his Bible and just beating me to death, It just went on. The only time we ever got out of there was for the Army-Navy game, which was normally in early December or late November, and then for Christmas, And I remember going back for Christmas. my mother had to actually throw me out of the house, plebe year, and say, get back and finish what you started. But it was pretty fascinating.
It's a different time. You know, we always say kindler, gentler today. I imagine you have some stories when it comes down to just...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, what hazing and those like things. Like,
hazing was perfectly fine. I mean, there was no, you know, I mean, there were no limitations, really. I mean, you couldn't beat the guy to death, but you could certainly hit on him, you
know. Right.
And if you were a plebe, you were lucky if you got a full meal in at any time there because of the stuff that it would do to you at the dinner table, you know. It was a lot different back then.
Well, sir, as we kind of wrap up here, I always like to ask my guests, if you found 15, 16-year-old, you know, Dave walking down the street, is there any advice you would give him, tips, tricks, tell him to do something different?
Well, I'll tell you what, that's one of the reasons I enjoy being here as a volunteer. You know, honor the past, but inspire the future, trying to get as many people interested in naval aviation as you possibly can. I think it's a superb way for a young kid to get it started now. The education you get in the military, whether it be ROTC scholarship or an academy or something like that, is always first rate. The flight training you would get as an aviator, you can't match it. You just can't match it. I mean, it's so good that the FAA actually waives now the requirement for an ATP to about 1,200 hours instead of the 1,500 or whatever it is that they're required. And so, yeah, I think the military service is a worthwhile thing. I really do. I'm just, you know, a little concerned that I gave up my commission. It still kind of eats at me at times. But being here to be able to hopefully talk to some of these young kids and try and give them a sense of feeling that this is really what you're doing is really a great career choice. And trying to get the other ones that haven't been in the military yet to think about it as a career.
Which is an important thing, because you know, there are more and more people that have no ties or connection to the military.
Right.
And if I had to go back and do it again, I think I would 100% go do it. The opportunities, experiences, the people you get to meet and work with, you can't find that anywhere else.
The camaraderie that you build up in the military is something, too, especially the guys that you end up flying in combat with. Well, those are guys I still keep in touch with today, even though we're getting a little long in the tooth, those of us that are still around. We still try and keep in touch with each other and all too, because you build a certain bond, you know, and that's something you'll never find in the civilian world. Never find it.
It's a completely different environment and different requirements, different mission that you're being asked to go out there and do. And again, like you said, like you won't find that anywhere else.
Yeah, I totally agree, John. Certainly do.
Well, sir, I really appreciate it. Thank you for just sitting down, chatting, and sharing your story.
That's been my pleasure. Yeah. Enjoy talking to you. Yeah.
Appreciate it, sir.
Go Navy. Beat Air Force.
I'll let it slide this one time. But, sir, thanks again for joining the podcast. Each remember to hope you enjoyed this. We got more coming your way.